Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I love that you said find the perfect guy for you because it also is, oh, no. This just dropped into my coffee. Hold on, I have to go one.
This is a disaster. Cassie's AirPod just fell into her coffee. Now she's sprinting to a bag of rice.
You still hear me. Okay.
Welcome, everybody, to a musical theater podcast where we discuss the cultural and emotional impact of some of our favorite shows in musical theater history. My name is Jeffrey Scott Parsons. You can call me Jeff. Today, we are talking about Matilda because it was a listener request from Jakari. So shout out to Jakari. I want to actually read his message that he sent us. Hi, Jeffrey. My name is Jakari, and I am a huge musical theater nerd. I am so fortunate to attend a school in Muskegon, Michigan that puts on Broadway-style shows every year. I know that may sound cliche coming from a high schooler, but the shows we put on are really spectacular. The next show you should cover is Matilda. This show has a special place in my heart because it is one of the shows that got taken away from me when the pandemic hit. I truly hope you consider covering this brilliant piece of art. Yes, Jakari. So this one's for you and for all of those kids who I know had many of their productions canceled this year. We love you, and musical theater is much older than any of us, and it's certainly much older than COVID, so we have a lot to look forward to. To make Jakari's dreams come true, I have one of my, like, ride or dies. Like, Cassie, you're one of my besties. I've had a lot of great friends and a lot of people that I'm very honored to call either professional or personal acquaintances on the show. But, like, we've known each other
for
14 years.
Very long
time. A long time.
I'm feeling so honored that you just said that.
It's true, though.
Keep it together.
You're one of my faves. This is everybody. It's Cassie Silva.
Hello.
Cassie, you starred in Matilda,
yes,
both on Broadway and on the national tour, where you originated the role of Mrs. Wormwood. And I got to see you in it at the Amundsen, and sitting in the audience watching you, I was so just exhilarated for you and so proud of you. And I think it's the type of feeling that I'm supposed to feel for myself.
Oh my gosh.
When I'm, like, you know, performing or having a great opportunity. But I just remember beaming, and I felt like I was walking on clouds for the next 2 days.
Oh my goodness.
Thinking about you doing Loud. You were so wonderful.
Thank you. I really appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
What does Matilda mean to you? I mean, I can guess, but what do you think?
Oof.
Has it become part of your DNA?
I think it is definitely part of my DNA. I remember when I first saw that show, hilariously, I was auditioning for the show, and I just went and I bought one of the super cheap seats. I was up in the very last row, so far back in the audience that they brought me a fold-out chair. Yeah, and because I had just decided on a whim, because, you know, I got the audition, and then I thought I should just catch the next show before I have this audition tomorrow. So I'm sitting there in this fold-out chair, and I didn't have my glasses. And so I'll never forget sitting and watching the show, blurry, and how well put together it was physically, which I also really appreciate about it. I think that Matilda, the musical, is a work of genius. I think it was created by geniuses. I think it's about a genius. And I'll never forget understanding it because of the way that they physically, you know, placed themselves around the stage that I didn't necessarily need to see faces or things like that. And the story still completely came through. And I remember watching it and thinking, I have to do this show. Like, this show seems so above me and so far ahead of me creatively. I want to know what that is. I want to know what's happening there. I want to know what they're doing in their rehearsals. I want to know how they're getting this type of performance out of not only young people, but older people as well. Like, what's in the water, right? And it very much felt like I'm leveling up. This is elevating me. Mm. This is challenging me in ways that creatively I haven't had the opportunity yet. And so it was really, really special to me, because as I continued to become successful and achieve things within that company, I could really feel the growth as a performer as well, and a professional too, because working with children is not a joke.
Seriously. When did you come into the whole process then? How long had the show been open?
So the show had been open for a year when I came into it. They had just performed at the Tonys, and I came in as a replacement for Betsy Stuxnes, who went to do a little show at the time called Hamilton. No big deal. And what was also fun is that all of the original Matildas, or perhaps it was the second round of Matildas, were all getting ready to go out. So I came in with a round of Matildas.
Oh, I see.
So one of the things that Matilda is known for, people would ask like, oh, you know, what show are you in or whatnot? And I'd say, oh, I'm in Matilda. And they would say, oh my gosh, I hear they are always rehearsing. They're always in rehearsal. And that was very true. We were in rehearsal a lot. And a lot of that had to do with just the upkeep of the show. Some of it had to do with a lot of the turnover in the show, working with children. But also a big component to Matilda is a lot of the magic means a lot of risk. So there's a lot of work done for safety specifically. So there's a lot of rehearsal. So it's very back and forth, having gone in for the first time with a set of Matildas going in and out, but then also being with the show for 2 years and having Matildas go in and out. It's like, you know, one moment you're in complete loss and grief over this child that you have grown some sort of, you know, creative attachment to, and also celebrating them and their ability to now sort of like be unleashed back into the wild of their life and like third grade, whatever it is. But then in the same moment, you have to turn around and show face and completely pull yourself together and welcome in a new child who has bright eyes and an open heart and like an alien brain. And here they are to completely hold a show. And fun fact, Matilda, they timed it once and they said that Matilda, the role, speaks. Now, this doesn't have to do anything with blocking or dancing or anything like that. She speaks verbally for 45 minutes straight.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Matildas average in age from 8 to, I think, 11 is the oldest. Can you imagine?
My gosh. I can't even imagine.
It's incredible. So imagine standing up next to a child that's holding an entire show, speaking for 45 minutes plus dance, plus, you know, full scenes.
Singing.
Plus they're doing stunts. They're doing, you know what I mean? And you try to say that you're tired that day, you know?
Right.
You try to have like
an attitude.
Exactly. Yeah, because they're just machines. They're incredible. And you know what's so great is that they're so stinking present. They look you straight in the eye. It's as if they're really in it. Oh, yeah. One of my, I mean, they're all my favorite. They really are. I've learned to accept that each of them is my favorite Matilda, but for totally different reasons. But there's one Matilda, my favorite. Just why I loved her was that she had such a positivity, and she would come off stage. This is months after playing the role. And she would come off stage. She would jump up and down. She would say, I really felt it tonight. I felt like I was really moving stuff. I was doing magic with my eyes. Come on with that.
That is so profound that by creating a magic trick for an entire audience of strangers, you have created magic that might as well be real for this child who's actually the one doing it.
Isn't it like, so brilliant?
Magic.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can imagine to release those ones into the wild is just like, oh, it's they hold such a precious place in your heart. Because I think also, in addition to them being really present, part of that is that they just, their creative will, their artistic will is infinite. So they're able to tap into that, you know, imaginary world. They're able to tap into the magic of it. And it does, and it can become very real for them. And so when I did Wormwood, such a dichotomy within myself, because I personally love children. They're one of my callings in this life. And Wormwood hates children, like loathes them. They make her gag. And then to look them in the eyes and to completely play with them and to yell at them and scream at them and berate them and abuse them. And sometimes they would wink at me, or like sometimes they would like, they just are so like- in on it. We know, right? They're just so sweet. I loved working with all of the children. They're all my favorite. I'd love to talk a little bit about the protocols and the safeties at Matilda, specifically with the children. It felt very important to Matthew Warchus, who is the director, that the children remain children at all costs. And that he wanted it to be as if they were being dropped off at the theater, like you would drop a kid off at soccer practice, and then they would be picked up as if they were picked up from gymnastics class. And it shouldn't really vary from their normal life. And so we had to follow a lot of protocol of, like, you know, no picking the children up, no distracting them, let them focus.
No autographs, right?
No autographs. They had their own entrance and exit from the theater so that they didn't meet fans and such. I know that some people have said, well, they've done such amazing work. Shouldn't they get that accolade? But I really stand behind just letting a kid do what a kid does. And for those kids, the caliber that they were performing at was normal to them. It really was their soccer lesson or their gymnastics class.
Yeah.
They would do 6 months to a year. You know, most of them 6 months, because they grow. And also, they don't want them to be trapped in a theater. They want them to have a childhood.
Wow. That's incredible. You put that up against the horror stories of Annie, you know, with with poor Andrew McArdle going to Studio 54 at 12 years old or whatever, and probably being introduced to, I mean, this is all, you know, allegedly, but like, well known enough to know that those sorts of boundaries hadn't been put in place. So it's commendable, if nothing else.
Yeah.
The show Matilda is, of course, based on the children's book Matilda, which was written by Roald Dahl. Roald Dahl, also known as the number one storyteller in the world, based on all of his books and stories that he wrote for youth, including James and the Giant Peach, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Matilda, of course, the BFG, The Witches, Fantastic Mr. Fox. The list goes on and on. I didn't realize what a long career this guy had.
Oh, yeah.
You know, James and the Giant Peach hits at like 1961. And of course, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the movies, so on and so forth. Matilda doesn't get released until 1988. So
the
usually people... Hey, hey! And thus the Matilda magic begins. But most of the time, writers have their greatest successes early in their life. And then it's a matter of, well, how do I keep a career going? But the fact is that as the years have gone by, Matilda, which is one of his very last works that he does, nearing 70 years old, is now outselling many of his earlier works. Mm. It's incredible that the popularity of Matilda has just grown and grown and grown. Did you read Roald Dahl stuff growing up?
Oh, yeah.
I did not.
You did not.
It was probably a little too stilted and scary for my household. Not that we like avoided it, but just simply that it wasn't Disney, so it didn't really find its way into my house. What were your faves?
My first chapter book was the BFG.
What, really?
Yeah, and I loved it so much.
How cute.
I also loved, at the time, they had just come out with the Angelica Houston film, The Witches. And so
own it.
So I really loved that one. Matilda was also one of my first chapter books. I loved Matilda. I really, in a really real way, I really resonated with Matilda. And so I just loved it because it helped me sort of get into my imagination and work through some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them have pretty much been made into some form of film. So I also got really into those because I had enjoyed the literature. So obviously then I became a fan of the films and the you know, adaptations. Actually, did you know that Anne Hathaway is coming out with a brand new Witches? I can't wait.
Yes, which I'm actually really excited about. Apparently, Roald Dahl washed his hands of the original because it changed the ending.
Ooh.
Which I didn't realize.
I didn't either.
In the original film of the Witches, the little boy gets turned back into a boy.
Oh.
Because at some point he becomes a mouse. And then at the end of the movie, he gets turned into a boy. And I don't believe that's how the book ends. So this new one is going to be a more faithful adaptation of the original story.
Oh, I'm excited.
Which I think is one of the true hallmarks of his stories. The endings are always somewhat, I don't want to say unsatisfying, they're always surprising.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't always tie everything up in a bow,
right,
in the way that Hollywood likes to.
Yeah, he's dark. He's a twisted sister. Yeah, I remember reading his biography and just being astounded. He went through some stuff.
Well, sometimes you read his stories and you think, does he even like children?
It's questionable, like, right?
Where does he stand on that?
I honestly don't think that he wrote for children. I think he really wrote for adults. And that's what they said about Matilda, the musical, is that it was written for adults with children in mind and that there are children mm-hmm. in it. But it's not a children's show. And sometimes I would even say to families, they're like, oh, there's kids in it. It must be such a family show. I'm like, you know, it is. But honestly, it's going to be more so for the parents than it is for the kids because it's dark.
He does not shy away from the dark. And I was like, I was a pretty sensitive kid and I didn't like... I've said this like so many times on the podcast. I always left the room when King Triton destroyed Ariel's grotto and when Mufasa died. Like, mm-hmm. I always needed to remove myself.
I didn't like Disney movies for those reasons.
There were too many feelings.
Yeah, I spent many Disney movies in my mother's like little shoulder hole.
Yeah.
Forget it.
So if that was too much for me, like Roald Dahl was
advanced.
Out of control.
Yeah.
Like, are you kidding me? Terrifying. But that being said, I appreciate the darkness now. I appreciate the opportunity to sit with art and learn how to process scary things.
Absolutely.
Because my life was a privileged one on a farm with a loving, supportive family. And a lot of those things did not enter my life.
Mm.
And without the children's literature, the children's art that I did consume, I'm not sure that it really would have until I was an adult. And then what kind of psychological mess do you find yourself in?
Right.
You know? Which brings me to this article I found. There is a professor from the University of Texas who has authored or co-authored a lot of papers on the cognitive development of children.
Ooh, I love it.
And it says there's some discussion about whether it's appropriate for preschool-aged kids to be exposed to scary content, whether that's stories or movies. And the general consensus among researchers, at least within the developmental psychology realm, is that there is some value to exposure within reason. These movies and stories might expose children to important life lessons, may help deal with negative emotions, including fear, anger, envy, jealousy, and I would include anxiety, which in 2020 has, you know, come to even greater heights. And I think it's uncomfortable for parents because I can imagine being a parent or an uncle with a kid who's like scared by the movie and crying, and I think, this has been the worst experience. I upset the child.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe just maybe the experience of them dealing with something scary in a safe place where I am right there to give them a hug and tell them, no, it's okay,
mm-hmm.
is the victory.
Right. To be able to use it as a tool to induce safety and security and camaraderie. Well, camaraderie is not the right word, but like
mm-hmm.
the
connection.
The connection.
Sure.
Right. I totally understand what that means.
So I appreciate that Roald Dahl goes there with it. And I also appreciate that the musical goes there with it, even more so than the movie version, which I also love. Did you see the Danny DeVito film?
Oh, yes.
I
loved it very much.
I mean, it's a great movie.
Yeah, but it's not. It's far for me, though. Like, it's sort of like a detached version.
It seems like to me that filmmakers have a hard time adapting faithful interpretations of the source material.
Right. The musical, just an FYI, was not written after the film. It has nothing to do with the film. Didn't even watch the film.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can tell.
Yeah. I had heard that they went through many different forms to adapt it, not only accurately, but appropriately for an audience. So they tried things like puppets, adults, no children, all children, only puppets. Wow. Like, the role of the Trunchbull is traditionally done as a man in drag. That also was part of that experimentation where they had done it with a woman and it just didn't hold the same gravitas and, like, danger that for whatever mm-hmm. reason a man could. And so also they needed something that could be so big, right? So, like, most Trunchbulls are very tall people. Mm-hmm. And then they would put them in these, like, huge costumes, which would make them look otherworldly. And part of...
like those original illustrations.
Right. Yes, exactly. Like the original illustrations. And then also part of that was that they needed something that people could dissociate from. So they needed something that was so scary and they would get the effects of this terrible, abusive, larger than life character. But also, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we know that's a guy in there. So you sort of can digest so much of Matilda for that reason. Because when it's a man in drag screaming at a small child, it's funny.
You can break up the discomfort with laughter.
Exactly.
That's so great.
And all of that was experimented on a lot. I always talk about Matilda as a Rubik's Cube, because, like I said, I think that it was created by geniuses and it's about a genius. But everything from the amount of people on the stage to what they're wearing to where they're standing is all completely calculated. And so when you go to something broader like the casting or the costuming or things like that, all of that is extremely calculated as well.
It's incredible. Now, when they decided to make it a musical in the 2000s, it was commissioned by the Royal Shakespearean Company. Mm-hmm. They were not trying to just create some fluffy children's musical. Mm-hmm. This is the Royal Shakespearean Company, y'all. That probably wanted to have a cash cow, but also has a really high mark in terms of artistic integrity. So in putting together this show, they get a director, like you mentioned, Matthew Warchus. How would you describe him?
Matthew Warchus is fascinating. You can just see so many clocks ticking at one time, and it all gets siphoned into a man of very few words. And so it's like,
wow,
a sentence from him would just be like, pew, for my brain, and I would have to go and, like, think about it. I feel so lucky that I was able to be under his direction.
A lot of his work was in plays. Mm-hmm. He won the Tony Award for God of Carnage. And I don't know if this was a first-time musical, but it was definitely a departure for him. Mm-hmm. Yet it almost seems like it was a perfect fit for how his brain works.
I agree. It just goes to the Rubik's Cube analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The writers were Dennis Kelly. He was the one who adapted the book and did mm-hmm. Matilda has such a great script.
Right? Yes, and truly. So often a good musical sometimes weighs too much on the music and the book
the
just kind of like,
yeah.
Matilda, mm-hmm. 2 years after doing it, words would hit me, music, lyrics would hit me, and I would be like, wait, what? Rubik's Cube, Rubik's Cube, Rubik's Cube. I mean, it's so deep. There's so much density in it. Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to be honest, Matilda... when I saw it, on top of, like, walking on cloud nine because of you, the other thing that sometimes I felt was like, can I get subtitles?
Yeah, you need it a few times in order to get a lot of it.
There are so many words.
Right.
There are all the words. And in melodies that are often so complex that I would go an entire verse and not be able to tell you anything that was said.
Oh, yeah. It's brilliant, and it's so fun to sing,
and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it just is.
I don't either. Look, I'd like to say something controversial at this point.
Go for it.
Matilda, the musical, is a British show. We brought it over from the West End. It was up against Kinky Boots for Best Musical.
Yes.
And Kinky Boots won over Matilda, the musical. I think it was robbed. I think there's no comparison, and I'm a Kinky Boots fan. I love Kinky Boots.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that there's no comparison. Maybe it's because I've been on the insides of it, but overall, it's a masterpiece.
I don't disagree with you. I would say that the first act of Kinky Boots is almost perfect.
I believe you.
Since we are talking about the Tony Awards, let's just go ahead and talk about them.
Okay.
This was 2013.
Mm-hmm.
on Broadway because the Matilda originally opened, I believe, in 2011 in London, was a huge hit, won more Olivier Awards than any musical prior. And then it opened on Broadway for the 2013 Tony season. It was nominated for Best Musical along with Kinky Boots, Bring It On the Musical, and A Christmas Story the Musical. Interesting group of musicals there.
Yeah, wide array.
Kinky Boots wins. The one that makes me really upset, I feel personally offended, is the choreography.
Oh.
How Matilda did not win Best Choreography with how...
It hurts my feelings.
Exact and interesting and innovative all of that movement and staging was is beyond me. Because here's the thing that I will say about Matilda. In terms of writing, it is absolutely terrific. But so much of the ingenuity of the staging and choreography, to me, play to the success of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, I'm not sure without all of those wonderfully creative ideas, it stands up as well as maybe should. Mm. I don't know. Because it was just so inventive.
Yes.
Every single number.
Yes.
Was.
Every single move was, like I said, calculated. It's like a Rubik's Cube. This show is built by geniuses about a genius. And I think that is also part of why you take one thing out and it doesn't quite work.
And it doesn't work
because
anymore.
You need all sides of the
you're
cube.
You're exactly right. Wow. Yes. This is so true.
Okay. So I'll say it here because you're my ride or die dancer first. Okay. I don't say it very often, but you've known me since like literally day one. So dance is something that I've had to stick in my back pocket going into musical theater because I've been pegged a lot as a dancer. So to get to pull it out for something like Matilda and to say, actually, I'm a strong dancer. Dance is my first language. This show blew my mind. And there would be points where I would be sitting, you know, like three theater seats away from Peter Darling during like a run or something.
Choreographer Peter Darling.
And I would literally be thinking to myself, I'll never forget this. I'm getting flushed and I have no idea why. But I would just look at him like creepishly and I would just think, you thought this up. Like you are the human being in this world that literally just was like sipping tea and you were like, I think we're going to put blocks through a gate. And then you thought that they have like letters on, and then you were like, let's get some swings. And like you thought of that. Like you just like thought it for breakfast. That's just like something you did for funsies.
Right.
Like, so the opening number, Miracle, is like 10-15 minutes. It would be one of those things where we'd like literally say goodbye to each other, you know, at the top of the show. We'd be like, see you in an hour, you know, because
see you on the other side.
Yeah. It all is so good. Oh my gosh. I love talking about this. There's so many pieces of that number. And it's, of course, brilliantly put together. If you can't tell, I'm just a huge fan of Matilda in general. I can't even believe that I got to do the show. But there's a piece that I'm thinking of within the opening number, Miracle, where the kids all roll out from underneath this table and they go into this like scene where each couple, parents, has a child and they're supposed to be at a birthday party and it's like watching each parent's personality, these couples, and how they react and respond to the child at the party.
So like there are stories happening in each family simultaneously.
Yes.
Even though it's an ensemble number.
Yes. And the choreography of this, one hand out of place, one angle 2 degrees off, completely alters the result of the end.
Picture.
It's just so beautiful. And there's cameras involved and the parents are like handing the camera back and forth to each other. The child is fighting over wanting to have their picture taken or not. And like the parents are either fighting with each other or getting along. It is so hilarious. It's such an epic display of what choreography can do within a show.
And so transportative.
Transportative.
Right?
That's a really great word for it. Transportative.
Because from the get-go, this movement in Miracle is so stilted and so unique that you almost are taken into a children's storybook in the way that those illustrations. And I need to look up the original illustrator because he worked with
spacing on it right now, but I used to know it.
Okay. Sir Quentin Saxby Blake.
Yes, Quentin Blake.
amazing.
Yes.
The way his illustrations take you into the story is the way that that opening number takes you into the story. Now, Peter Darling, choreographer of Billy Elliot,
yes,
as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's given us some incredible choreography and musical theater already, and I can't wait to see what else he does. The music and lyrics were written by Tim Minchin. Mm-hmm. Is that who says the name?
Another genius. Yes, Tim Minchin. Writer and comedian.
Who is Australian.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe him? Like musician, comedian?
He's a kook.
He kind of did his own thing with not Cabaret the musical, but Cabaret the art form.
Ooh.
A little bit of stand-up comedy, a little bit of musical theater. Mm-hmm. And when asked about it, this is a quote from him that I feel like really sheds light on who he is. I'm a good musician for a comedian, and I'm a good comedian for a musician. But if I had to do any of them in isolation, I don't know. He has like kind of frizzy red hair.
Mm-hmm. But he rats. And then tons of eyeliner. The warmest, loveliest, most charismatic human being, I think.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
And also a deep soul. Because when you get into the show and you see how unexpected some of the musical choices are,
mm-hmm.
and we can talk about that coming up, you see, oh, you're not just a kook. You're like a kook with a soul.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's also one of the great things about Matilda the musical is that for as cerebral as it is, it also has such a wild imagination and such a deep understanding of play. When you really look at art as play, there's so much of that happening within the show. And you hear it a lot within the lyrics, within the music.
I love that. Let's talk through the show, shall we?
Yeah, totally. I was going to add that the quote that you read, the Tim Minchin quote, mm-hmm. very much feels like my career. That describes me and my talents. Like I was talking about like dancer first. Like I don't know that I can do one without the other.
That's how I always feel. Absolutely. I always want to go into a singing call and be like, but wait till you see me dance. And then I want to go to a dance call and be like, but wait till you see me hear me sing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you're like, but throw me a set of sides. You'll never
know. My cold read is on point.
It's frozen.
It's stone cold.
It's on ice. Triple Lutz.
Triple Lutz.
Okay. Talk through the great. Show.
Yeah, let's talk through the show.
Okay.
Now, Roald Dahl said that a lot of Matilda came from his experiences at boarding school as a young person. And right from the get-go, at the beginning of Matilda the musical with this miracle number, we're kind of painted two versions of life. You have the version of life in which you are kind of a spoiled child, adored by your parent and told that everything that you do is perfect.
Yes, it's a miracle.
Everything's a miracle, mm-hmm. right? And it will soon be juxtaposed by the time in which you go to school and are told that everything you do is exactly the opposite of that.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. That these are like two necessary evils that are always pushing up against each other, when in reality, maybe it should be a more evenly dispersed experience across the board. But even more of a juxtaposition to these families is the birth of Matilda herself,
mm-hmm.
who is born to these parents who, from the get-go, loathe her.
Yes.
Her dad doesn't like her because, turns out, she's a girl.
Right.
And her mom, Mrs. Wormwood, was not even aware that she was pregnant. In fact, she was on her way to the
biannual International Amateur Salsa and Ballroom Dancing Championship in Paris. That was not perfect. That was not a perfect British accent, unfortunately.
Mrs. Wormwood is absolutely ridiculous. How much does that wig weigh?
8 to 11 pounds. And the microphone batteries are in it.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. So, I mean, you are playing a drag queen, essentially, because you have so much makeup on.
Yes.
You've got this incredibly heavy wig.
Yes.
Which
I would argue is part of how I was even able to pull off the role. Because I'm typically, like, for a typical Wormwood, far too young. I still am too young.
Right, right.
But I think because of sort of the cartoon feature, I was able to have that opportunity. True. True facts.
On Broadway, it was played by Leslie Margarita,
mm-hmm.
who is kind of a freak of nature unto herself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious, over the top. And when you listen to her section of Miracle on the cast album,
mm-hmm.
all I can think of is she really did that 8 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe as a freak of nature she was. But then what it did was kind of set up an almost impossible track for someone like you to play.
Right.
And I think that that was one of your true assets, is that you figured out how to do this role
mm-hmm.
8 times a week and not go down.
Yeah.
3 weeks into the run.
True. Yes. I really find great enjoyment at the athleticism of like the sport of performing, and especially something like a Broadway schedule, which is 8 times a week plus press. I find that really interesting. And I also had a really good team behind me. I trained with somebody for voice, for accent, for vocal health. I trained with an actual vocal coach for singing and stamina and endurance and breathing, especially with the costume, because it was very tight and it was around my waist, so it was hard to breathe. And then also there is a trick skirt and a magic element. So, and also I was going upside down in some of those moments. Not to mention that I also had all of the coaching and whatnot from, again, like the Matilda team, then a PT. I also had a vocal masseuse that like could go in and like massage. Just incredible. I mean, these people are incredible. I did not do it alone at all. But I do think that my artistic will was so great and I was quite determined. And it also just in a really strange way, it just made sense to me. I was like, I can do that. Mm. I know that I can do that. And you know, I don't tell the story very often, but I will tell it to you here. Leslie Margarita was in the production of West Side Story when I was in high school. My sister did West Side Story with Leslie Margarita. Her 3 second long theater career. and at that time, they were just giving tickets away to fill seats. And I went to every single show that they did of this production of West Side Story. And Leslie Margarita played Anita. And I think I was like 14 years old. And I will never forget her singing A Boy Like That. My whole body, every single time, would have this visceral response to her performance and her voice. And that was my moment when I was like, I want to do this. I don't know even what, I don't even know what this is, but I want to do what that lady is doing. And very similarly, again, when I went to see Matilda blindly, remember, I'll never forget Leslie Margarita like throwing her arms up in the air and hitting these very specific poses and just making me like laugh until I cried and I couldn't see anything.
Wow.
And also,
that's awesome.
Also being backstage with her, she's a warhorse, like she never goes down. And so I also had that instilled in me where I had seen that it could be done. You know, like she mm-hmm. never got sick. She never called out. She booked a film while I was there and I got to play Wormwood for a point of time. But that was pretty much the only time that she did go out.
Because she was also working.
She was. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I don't tell that story very often. But yeah, she did. She had like a big hand back in the day when I first started theater, literally. And I think also I just was pretty relentless in my endeavors. So
absolutely. I think that there's so much to be said for making up your mind. The decision's already been made.
Yeah.
You're going to do it. So now let's just do it. Let's figure out how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I looked at it the same way that like you would do drills for football. Do they do drills for football? Is that right? Okay, great. I don't play sports. I look at it the same way. So like, you know, I didn't even mention anything like the steaming, the warm-ups, the warm-downs. Like, I'm not the first nor the last person to say that when you do a show 8 times a week, it dominates your life and everything revolves around you getting on that stage.
And it does.
And it does, yeah. And it's just a learning curve. So I think that could be why some people have struggled. Yeah.
Despite being born into a family that has no use for her,
mm-hmm.
Matilda proves to be a pretty special child.
Yes.
In many ways, she is the miracle that all of the parents surrounding her are pretending their child is.
Right.
In this environment where Matilda is not really loved or appreciated at home, she begins to find ways to deal with all of that. What? All of that
pent up anger,
stuff.
Aggression.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Because even though she is a miracle, she's still a human being with resentments and needs that are not being met at home. Cue a song called Naughty, which I think is a really wonderful song because it's taking a look at why are children naughty? Where's that coming from? There's always something more than just a child was born rotten. And in this case, in a very self-aware way, Matilda is choosing to act out because it's at least a source of power that she can find by inflicting these little naughty, mischievous choices that she makes in her family. Her father is always obsessed with doing his hair, so she puts bleach into his hair gel to make his hair go all crazy. At another time, she puts glue in, like super glue in the hat. So now not only is the hair bleached, but it's like stuck to a hat. And it really makes Matilda a well-rounded character. She's not just this perfect anomaly that...
She's not a doormat.
Yes. And she has this thirst for knowledge. So she finds herself going to the library, right? Where she meets the librarian named Mrs. Phelps. And
shout out. Mrs. Phelps, I feel like, is always like the role that nobody talks about. She's on
shout
stage
out,
so
Phelps.
Much. Shout out to Mrs. Phelps.
They start having this really beautiful relationship where Matilda will tell her stories, right?
Yes.
And she starts telling her the story about an acrobat and a...
An escapologist.
Yes. And what is that? An escapologist?
An escape artist. Like, they changed it when it came to the U.S. because it was hard for Americans.
We're dumb. I'm sorry. Like I said, subtitles for my own language.
When I was on tour, we started to have handouts with lyrics on it. Yeah. And it's very wordy. And one of the easiest examples I can give you about the accent, which sort of changed over time, was that typically you would say, I'm a girl, to say I'm a girl. So it sort of started to evolve where then they would start to put in like a little bit of an R when they were on Broadway. And she'd be like, I'm a girl, right? By the time we got to tour, it was like, I'm a girl. Girl. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Which... You know, like my actor heart is like, gugum.
Right.
But then as like an American actor, understanding in places like Texas, it's really difficult to switch from one accent to another. You know, I understood. And it's part of our job to get it across.
Communicate.
And to
absolutely.
Be able to communicate. So there was a lot, especially with Wormwood, because she I can't even get that high now. But like she resonates all the way up here, like in the nose, nasal area. Forget it. Like I used to have to literally chew my words in order to get everything out and try to time it so that it was almost very manufactured in some respects, just trying to help the audience get the plot points that I was trying to get across.
That's crazy. But
worth it. Like, I used to say that all the time. I'd be like, this, if it was any other show, I don't know, but this one is worth it.
So the story that Matilda's telling Mrs. Phelps, that she's just making up off the top of her head, is about this escape artist and an acrobat.
An acrobat.
And they can't have a child, right?
Yes.
So instead, they're like creating this amazing death-defying act. Now, this is kind of a plot point that continues throughout the show. Every once in a while, we go back to Matilda with Mrs. Phelps, who's continuing to tell this story about these two people. At this point, Matilda goes to school, and like we said, school is horrible because now instead of being a miracle, you are scum. And the school is called...
Crunchum Hall.
See, that's the other thing about Roald Dahl, is like such interesting words, and like he made up a lot of words that were very, very cool.
Right?
So when Matilda goes to school, when all the children go to school for the first day, there is a song aptly titled... School song. Can you please take us through the choreography of this number? Because it's in San, and I've never seen anything like it.
Yes. The older kids at the school are sort of welcoming / traumatizing the little kids.
Like you do.
That are just starting school. Right. I think they think that it's warning, but some would argue that it's abusive, which is fine.
Yeah.
So it's this incredible number where there's these two gates, a set piece, and... They have all of these different color squares shaped into it. And as the song goes along, the lyrics start spelling out the alphabet, which I'll say more about in a minute. And they start taking these blocks. The cast starts to turn into almost like a machine, if you will. And these blocks start coming out of nowhere behind the gates. And all different shapes and sizes, these blocks shoot through the square shapes in the gates. And they start spelling the alphabet as there's two literally climbing and jumping and on the gates. And blocks are shooting through the gates.
And appearing at the very moment that their foot is stepping on the block.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You don't breathe the entire number.
And it's so brilliantly written lyrically. It spells out the alphabet like it goes, and so you think you're able to survive this mess by being a prince or a princess, you will soon see. There's no escaping tragedy. So that's just like a taste of what goes on. Oh, I want to tell you the story about the time that I fudged, which was
the day you broke Matilda.
The day I broke Matilda. So I was behind the gates when I first went into the Broadway production, and I was one of the people that pushes the blocks through the gates. Now, sometimes these blocks are really small, like I said, and sometimes they're huge. And sometimes just because of the way that the gates are and the boxes are and the weather is and whatever, the boxes can sometimes get stuck or they have a hard time getting through. So you can only imagine the levels of anxiety that you feel having this responsibility, knowing that if it doesn't go in at the exact time that the person on the front is depending on it. So I go to push one through and I can't get it in and it gets stuck. And the guy on the front falls.
No.
And obviously these are like Olympic athlete type people. He was totally fine. But at the end, we're like in the super straight line and we exit off stage. And I'll never forget. I walked straight past the wing. I cleared the wing. I went straight into like the backstage area. And there's a staircase that went up to the kids' dressing room. And I just sat down. I put my head in my hands and I just sobbed for like a solid 60 seconds.
Oh.
It's a sad memory, but it's such a great memory because I just remember being so in it. And you really feel this camaraderie that I think is so special to theater. You really do build this closeness with each other and you have such a deep level of trust.
But I'm glad it's a great memory, a sad, great memory.
Sad, but great memory.
Now at school, the headmistress is Miss Trunchbull, who is a former world champion hammer thrower, of course.
Hilarious.
And she is the worst, as we talked about. It's usually played by a man in drag. She's created something called the Chokey, which she puts children into, which is this like scary dungeon closet, which I think is... Like, I remember my brother shoving me into a closet and turning out the lights and telling me there were spiders in there, and that was, like, the worst thing ever, right? Which, now that I think about it, like, it's not that big a deal. There was plenty of space in the closet, but just the idea of it being dark and an enclosed space that I couldn't get out of.
Right.
So the Chokey's terrifying. Now, the one bright spot is that Matilda's teacher is named Miss Honey. Miss Honey recognizes something in Matilda, that she is smart, that she deserves to excel, maybe even faster than her classmates. And yet, in order to get some sort of special privilege for her, Miss Honey needs to stand up to Trunchbull.
Right. So she's very much Matilda's a catalyst for Miss Honey.
Absolutely.
And I also think Miss Honey is the first interaction, perhaps, outside of like the librarian, maybe, but especially in the musical, I think she's the first genuine and warm encounter that Matilda's ever seen. It's like she's seen a unicorn.
Mm.
It's like, what?
Humans don't act like
this. I've never seen anything like, yeah, totally. Also, I don't know if this is just information for you or for the podcast, but it's been said so many times that Matilda is on the spectrum. That both of the Wormwood children are on the spectrum and that they actually swing both ways, where the son is sort of on like a like non-communicative.
Sure.
And that Matilda lives on sort of this, is it savant? Like a prodigy, Rain Man esque type thing. And that does, honestly, it makes a lot of sense. And when you think about sort of her unruliness and her naughtiness and like the ratty hair and things like that and some of her decisions. Also, if you listen to some of her words, she's a bit inept. She's socially inept in some ways.
Wow.
She's never really socialized. Remember, like, she only knows characters in the book. So I don't know. It always made sense to me.
Mm.
But it is otherworldly, so some people just chalk it up to that. But people that look at it very like, these are people that could live in London, mm-hmm. type of thing. I don't know.
That's awesome. Now that leads Miss Honey to go to Matilda's house.
Right.
Because even if she can't get to Trunchbull, she's at least going to go try to talk to the parents and try to convince them of the special child that they have. Now, we all know how that is going to go. Which is hilariously by way of a production number called Loud.
Yes.
So take us through Loud.
Loud was such an honor to perform. Why I love Loud is because it bookends Matilda's 11 o'clock number in the second act, which I know we'll get to, her number Quiet. Mm. So there's Loud.
Wow.
And then there's Quiet.
I didn't even think about that. That's
really
incredible. Same family, two completely different perspectives.
Right. Yes. And two different approaches to how to deal with things. And I think that knowing how Quiet was directed really helped inform, because in some ways, the bigger and more obnoxious and louder that I would be able to perform it, the greater and bigger payoff Matilda would get in Act Two. And when you're up there with these little guys, you would do anything to support them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this crazy number where Mrs. Wormwood is fantasizing about the dance championships that she wants to get to. It starts just in the living room. She is having dance rehearsal with her partner Rodolfo, and basically could care less about the fact that Miss Honey is there, and really almost feels offended that Miss Honey would come all the way over here to let me know that my child is special.
Is smart.
In any way.
Like intellectual,
and
because
smart.
That's not going to get you anywhere. What's going to get you somewhere is to be loud and make yourself be heard.
Yeah, and she even says, it's a very popular line from the show, which is, looks are more important than books. That's loud.
And that's loud. Now let's go back to the library, where Mrs. Phelps has come back on stage to sit and listen, like every good actor should. Mm-hmm. And Matilda is continuing her story about the acrobat and the escape artist. Now,
right.
What's interesting is that as Matilda is getting closer and closer to Miss Honey, she eventually starts to realize, and we're kind of skipping ahead here, that the story she is telling is Miss mm-hmm. Honey's story.
Yes. Spoiler.
So
yes.
In addition to Matilda's intelligence and everything else, she's also developing this ESP Carrie White type situation where she can clairvoyantly read the past, see the future, make things fly, and all of these things start picking up faster and faster throughout the rest of the show. Two of the really fun magical moments at the end of the first act are the Amanda Thripp moment and the Bruce Bogtrotter moment, both of which yeah. involve Trunchbull. She grabs Amanda Thripp by the pigtails. Why? Because she hates pigtails.
Right.
And swings her around and throws her like a hammer. And it's a very famous moment in the book, in the movie, and it's amazingly staged in the musical version. Another very famous moment with Bruce involves a chocolate cake, because he, being a little Roald Dahl chocolate lover, which there are many mm-hmm. in his stories, has stolen a piece of cake from Trunchbull. Now, you were the cook, right? When you first
yes.
go into the show, you were the cook of the cake.
I was the cook of the cake.
But of course, there's yes. no way you're going to tell us how it worked, right?
No.
Okay. I figured.
But can I instead trade you for a fun fact about the Bruce cake?
Yes. Because just so everyone knows who may not have seen it, Bruce is then forced to eat this entire chocolate cake. It's huge.
It's like life-sized. Yeah, it's huge.
And he does so on stage. It doesn't happen off stage. It happens on stage.
Yes, which is this incredible element of theater magic, especially if you're sitting super close, because it's like close-up magic. Like, you literally just watch him devour this this epic-sized cake, of which I cannot give you hints. But what I will say is that of all the Bruces that I worked with throughout my time at Matilda, the majority of them did not care for chocolate.
What is wrong with children? I have.
I don't know. I was like, I'll do it.
My nieces and nephews are exactly the same. They
seriously
like chocolate chip cookie dough without the chocolate chips.
What?
So my
That's
mom
sugar cookies.
My mom will make chocolate chip cookie dough, but then just not put in the morsels, and that's what they love.
Oh my gosh!
And I don't understand.
Wow, I don't understand either. What is happening in the world?
I don't know. I think it's a taste bud thing. They, you know, kids really like the plain.
I guess so.
The plain nothing. And then you know, you get to be 30 and you're like, 90% cacao, please.
Yeah, I am all for a chocolate chip.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You and
I'll eat all the chocolate chips.
Are both chocolate chip cookie enthusiasts. Yes.
Absolutely.
Remember in your theater bio when you used to wish everyone a million grilled cheese sandwiches?
Oh my gosh. Do you know something funny about that? Is recently I went on to the browser of Gmail, where I have, you know, my email, and I sent an email from the browser version of Gmail. Mm. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, like the laptop, not your phone.
Yes. And I sent this to a professional person and didn't realize that it had saved wishing you a million grilled cheese sandwiches as my signature. And they wrote back, they said, a grilled cheese sandwich would be really good right now. And I thought, oh my gosh,
I think in 2020, you might need to bring it back. That would make life much better.
Yes, I don't know. I've always just wanted to be a little different with the play aspect of things. I don't know.
I love it. That's what makes you catsy. Okay, at the top of Act Two, there's this infomercial that Mr. Wormwood does with his son called Telly, which is such a Roald Dahl thing because in many of his stories, he hates television, feels like it's rotting the brains of children. And this infomercial that these two characters are doing is instructing the audience, enough talk about books. Let's watch more television, please.
Yes.
Hilarious. So British.
It's so good. And it's so well done. And I just want to say, if I may, about the roles of Mr. Wormwood and Michael Wormwood. So much training goes into the comedy and timing of those two roles in order to make them funny. And typically what I also have found personally as playing like murderers, antagonists, biatches, such and such, is that
because God painted you fierce.
I love you for saying that. It takes so much focus and also, I think, compassion. And specifically for the roles of Mr. Wormwood and Michael Wormwood, across the board, they have always been the most intelligent gentlemen, as well as classically trained.
Wow.
Like Quinn Matfield, who I did the tour with, Shakespearean guy.
Wow, incredible.
And so I always thought that Telly, it was such a brilliant display of physical comedy mixed with breaking the fourth wall. And so I just wanted to give a shout out to all the wormies.
To all the worms. I love it. Now, even though that starts the second act, then you get to like the actual number that starts the second act, which is When I Grow Up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Now.
Yeah, it takes a few starts. We have to start Act Two a few times.
It's a little like.
Yeah, exactly. And here we go.
Because When I Grow Up is such a memorable moment in the show, I remember getting teary-eyed. Look, put swings on a stage, I'm there. I don't know why. There's something so magical about swings.
Agreed.
But like seeing these little children, it's so beautiful and so wistful, and it's one of my favorite numbers in the show. And to have it come after Telly, like, it's kind of all over the place, and yet it works.
Right. You almost need you need both of them in order to get the brain break so that you can commit to the rest of Act Two.
Because it does get pretty dark.
Yeah.
That's true. In honor of When I Grow Up, I have invited you to bring something from your childhood, a journal moment, if you will, to share with everyone.
I think you should go first.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay.
I have an entry from my journal entitled All About Me.
Of course you do.
This is so embarrassing. It's in cursive. This entry in my childhood journal is June 31st, 1994 at 9:20 p.m. I don't know why I wrote the time, but that's fantastic. It says, today I'm going to write something in this journal, and I'm amazed that I haven't wrote it before.
I love it.
I finally realized that someday, somehow, I'm going to be a star. Maybe even the greatest performer ever! Exclamation point.
Finally.
My talent comes in the arts. Then I start explaining.
Okay.
You see, my talent comes in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
I love dancing and singing, and no person like Rocky or Danny, who are obviously bullies from elementary school, are going to tell me I'm a wimp. I want to grow, and the jerks who made fun of me will say, man, I can't believe I was actually mean to him. Again, I've never wrote this before, but I'm proud of me, and I'm the best.
Oh.
Thanks for listening. Love, Jeffrey Parsons. And then I drew my own trophy.
Oh. This is the most precious thing I've ever seen.
I drew a trophy, and on the trophy it says Jeff Parsons, greatest performer.
Because
that's an award.
Of all time. Oh my gosh.
Ridiculous. This kind of set for me the pattern that my journals are incredibly boring. And I love writing, but I only use the journal to be a cheerleader for myself. Oh. So every single journal entry is usually like, it's okay, man. Things are going to be fine.
Oh my gosh.
It's just, they're just books full of it gets better. Anyway.
That's great. Hey, you know, people use journaling for all different types of things.
Okay, what you got? What'd you bring to the table?
Mine's a little longer.
Awesome.
I don't know that I can amount to what just occurred, but I will certainly try.
It's not a competition. Although apparently it is because I got a trophy.
Okay, so this I made with my best friend at the time, so I'm going to read mine off of this.
Okay.
But awesome. This says, Cassie and Anzi's list of ambitions.
How old were you?
10 or 11. Okay, so I was obsessed with A Walk to Remember growing up. Mm. So in the movie A Walk to Remember, Mandy Moore's character writes this like bucket list of things that she wants to do before she dies. And it's like a big part of the movie. And then she falls in love with Shane West, yeah. Who like at that time was all that in a bag of chips and a side soda. Yeah. So Obvi had to make our own list. First and foremost, at the very top of the page, above the list is number one is fall in love.
Oh, shoot.
which is before the actual number one on the list.
You wrote the list and then you're like, you know what? Forget it.
I've rethought it.
I already regret everything. Number one, fall in love.
Yes. Okay, here we go. Number one, the real number one on the list.
Okay.
Examine Shane West. A lot.
Examine?
Number two, get a tattoo with glitter.
I think you might need to invent that before you can do it.
That's how
ambitious.
Well, you know what's so funny is that at the time, remember, I was like 10 or 11, I was going to a lot of the older friends' bat and bar mitzvahs in the community. And so sure. You would go and get fake tattoos or like, you know, those little like airbrushing booths that they would have at those parties, and then they would put glitter on it, and I think that's where I got it from.
You want to be edgy, but like with glitter.
But with glitter.
I get that. That is my brand.
Look, everybody loves a good sparkle, and it is your brand. I agree with you. Number three.
Number three.
Get on a TV show - starring.
Oh.
Ambitions.
I mean, you've done that one, right?
Yeah, some of these are great to go back to because I realize, oh, I did pretty well, which is, I made my 10-year-old self proud.
For sure.
I mean, I'm still working on the actual number one.
Come on, Shane.
Okay, four. Really driving this one home. Find a perfect guy.
Ooh, not possible, girl.
Number five, be successful, parenthesis, famous. One and the same. Okay, right. Number six, similarly, is be discovered. And then there was a revision, as you can see, I've now written in pen, which says soon.
Oh.
God
bless. Nothing like a timetable for a bucket list.
Okay, number seven, change someone's life for the good, which is also, I think, one of the first ones where we've included other human beings.
That's really sweet. I love that. You're generous.
Number eight, read 100 books to help myself. Check.
You're like, I'm on 237.
Okay, number nine, tell people the good in them.
These are great.
Number 10, compliment at least, all caps, one person a day, all caps. Jeffrey, I love
Look,
you. I think you're doing a fabulous job on this podcast.
Cassie, and I need to say, I am incredibly impressed because as someone who came up through the studio dance world, this is a well-rounded little girl.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you for sharing. That's amazing.
Thanks for listening to both sides of the paper.
Side A and B.
Side A and B. And now she goes back into the archives.
Well, it's important to have these archives because, you know, when we grow up, that is an important question that we ask ourselves.
So I was lucky enough to be one of the people that was on the swings.
Ugh.
And I would choke up more often than not.
Aww.
Because it just was such... It's just such a magical moment of swinging over the heads of this audience and just seeing this like flood of wonder and awe. And, you know, Matilda's magical for so many reasons. And theater at large, too, is just this really important piece of escapism. And so to see people like come out of that shell and to just embrace this larger than life moment just was so special. And also the set for When I Grow Up has two walls at the very back of the stage. They don't close all the way because there's a slide that goes through them.
Okay.
Like a real life slide. In order to make this look very realistic, there's like tree branches that stick out from the walls that sort of, you know, you slide underneath them and it's like this foliage, right?
Yeah.
And so we all slide down, you know, then get ready, and then we all go on these swings. It's this very epic built-up moment. Okay, so there were a lot of costume changes in Matilda and also very swift changes. So our wigs were just lightly pinned. You can see where this is going. So I go down the slide, and I have this, like, very pretty blonde, like, little, like, bun with bangs, and it catches on the foliage and just rips off, like the little rascals, and I just go flying down the slide in a wig cap into I land from the slide, and I'm supposed to like high five and greet an actual small child who then is looking at me and like tearing because we're trying to not laugh.
So you're
no way.
You didn't have time to go like grab the wig off
the branch. It was hanging from the branch. Because I couldn't reach it because it's all the way up at the top of the slide. I couldn't even sing. There were, unfortunately, at that performance, there were no background vocals from me because I was crying.
Oh my gosh.
Bye.
That is the best story.
Pretty good. When I Grow Up.
When I Grow Up. There it is. Now, back to the library with Mrs. Phelps, where, like we said, Matilda has realized that Miss Honey's story is the story. And in the story of the acrobat and the escape artist, they've created this really dangerous stunt that goes horribly wrong. The mom dies, but her unborn child lives, which is Miss Honey.
Yes.
So now you've got this father in mourning. You've got a newborn child. They're both completely unprepared for each other. He calls upon his sister to come help raise her. And the aunt, the sister, unbeknownst to the father, mistreats her terribly. She's an evil, evil aunt. Now, as Matilda's starting to put all the pieces together, if the child is Miss Honey, then her evil aunt is actually...
Dun, dun, dun!
Trunchbull! Can you believe it? Miss Honey and Trunchbull are actually related. And the trauma of Miss Honey not being able to go talk to Trunchbull comes from years and years of an abusive childhood.
Well said.
Thank you. And the father, he left one day and never came back. And Miss Honey had no idea what happened. Matilda starts putting it together that maybe Trunchbull is responsible for the father's disappearance, because if he were to disappear, she would inherit a lot of stuff.
Everything.
Yeah, everything. Right. So with all of this information and just kind of she's had it with these grown-ups treating people horribly, it all culminates with this song, which you mentioned before, called Quiet. And I think that this is when, like, the Royal Shakespearean Company comes out. Because never before have I heard, you know, an 11 o'clock number for our lead character be so still, be so quiet. Mm. And yet it is this moment where she really finds her next level of power.
Right.
Now, all of that power, she then puts into moving objects. She's able to do this really interesting thing with a salamander to terrorize Trunchbull. Oh, a newt!
A newt is like a really ugly lizard that lives in water.
Is that lavender line that she says, like, walking across the stage?
Yeah.
Did not understand one word the entire time.
Oh, my God.
The true stars, for sure.
True.
Now, speaking of lavender, she's about to be thrown into the chokey, right? When Matilda finally unleashes her biggest plan and greatest power to date. Which is that in order to enact revenge or justice, let's say justice, on Trunchbull for what she did to Miss Honey's father, what she's done to the children for who knows how long, Matilda is able to move the chalk on the chalkboard with her brain, with her mind, with her will, with her spirit, if you will, and writes on the chalkboard as though she is the ghost of Miss Honey's dead father, saying, yes. I know what you did. And this freaks out Trunchbull so much that she, right then and there, runs off property, keeps running, and we never hear from her again.
Ever.
And this results in Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. It's really the biggest crowd pleaser in the entire show called Revolting Children.
Yes.
I remember you talking to me because you have since directed and choreographed a production of Matilda using only kids, which I went and saw, and it was fantastic. You did such an amazing job.
Thank you for coming.
But I remember you telling me about working with the kids on this number and kind of the visual behind it, and it was what you were told as well. Can you share that with everybody?
Yes. So Revolting Children is this, it's this number that involves this huge emotional eruption. I used to say it's like taking a soda bottle and shaking it and then just opening up the cap and just letting everything fly out of it.
Yes, I love that. I'm stealing that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, please do. And they would give us the visual that the Trunchbull was running away. And as the Trunchbull runs away, she gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And that was to be used as a metaphor for freedom, for our freedom. It becomes primal, almost tribal. And Peter Darling, I'm totally going to butcher this name, but I'm going to try anyway. He got inspiration for the choreography of Revolting Children from the Tiahuaca, something like that, tribe.
Oh, wow.
And you can see this choreography by way of like shaking hands as if it's the tail of a rattlesnake.
Whoa, that's so cool.
Yeah, or like the clapping of like the forearms. All of this is symbolic of this tribal dance, this taking over the territory, of getting to a place that you have to go beyond basic choreography. You have to go beyond basic shape because you're free.
Wow.
It's epic.
It's a children's show, people. And this is the kind of thought. Like, we have no excuse. We have no excuse as artists, no matter how much time we have to rehearse, to not be as thoughtful as the artists that came before us when creating this stuff. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, I just feel such a responsibility to carry that onward. That
absolutely.
Even if you're working with children, you don't just do step touches. You think about the emotional content of these stories and infuse it with that kind of artistry. And maybe people will get it. I certainly didn't know any of this by watching it. But maybe, just maybe you feel it. And that's all there is to it.
I loved it.
Okay, let's wrap this mother up. So,
okay.
With Trunchbull gone, Miss Honey becomes the new headmistress.
Yay!
And she does a beautiful job. Now, I think that a happy ending to this story would be that the Wormwoods realize what a special daughter they have and say we're sorry. But
plot twist.
But in a very Roald Dahl type of ending.
They don't.
In fact, what has happened is the father has sold these lemons, these non-working vehicles, to the Russian mafia, who are now after the Wormwoods. And so
a total side story that's been happening.
Just a random
show,
plot.
Right?
Side plot. Yeah. And so they're like, come on, Matilda, we gotta go. And Miss Honey's like, well, how about she stay with me? You know, I can adopt her. And Mrs. Mm-hmm. Wormwood, in probably the most selfless act she's ever done, is she gives up her child.
Yes.
And so it is a happy ending while also not being a traditional happy ending at all.
Right.
And that's life, ladies and gentlemen.
I really like how it ends.
Me too.
Because I like to think that there are always options and there are always choices.
Yes.
And also what I appreciate about it is that in some senses, it's pretty realistic. In terms of what the options are, because the Wormwoods are never going to change. And I think that that is a level of acceptance that we bump up against as humans, like as adults, a lot. And sometimes you just have to make a bigger change. Sometimes you have to turn to avenues that might be less popular or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like to make those big changes in your life. Rather than trying to control somebody or to live in denial of somebody. And I love that you found something that I found, which is like, by giving Matilda up, that is one of the most selfless things that she's ever done. And what's funny about it is that the way that she does that is she literally goes, eh. And she can't even find words for it. She can't even communicate with words. To me, it felt really profound that like, even though she couldn't really communicate it, she could at least try to like sound it out. There is that glimmer of hope that maybe she might be able to get it one day.
Mm-hmm.
That like that feeling of having to vocalize it via sound, like maybe one day she'll realize that that was the first glimpse of compassion or selflessness or something like that, you know? So yeah, I mean, a bit long-winded, but that's kind of what I think about it.
That's beautiful.
And also, I love that Matilda ends up with Miss Honey because they are one and the same. They are just kindred spirits. And that almost seems like how it always was meant to be.
Absolutely.
You know?
Soulmates.
Penguins.
They see each other because
they
are each other. A doppelganger
they
type situation.
They see each other because they are each other. That's how I feel about you.
Oh. Thank you so much for doing this. I've had such a wonderful time talking with you about
Thank
this really interesting show, hashtag the Rubik's Cube, that I think will continue to inspire a lot of audiences.
Agreed. I hope it does. It's truly magical.
As always, if you have recommendations you'd like us to cover on A Musical Theater Podcast, you can email me at amusicalpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow us on social media, Twitter and Instagram, @amusicalpodcast. And you know what? Don't forget to hop on over to the Tee Public store where we have designs dedicated to favorite moments from episodes past and present. Cassie, how can we follow you and everything you're up to? Because I know you've got some exciting stuff coming out.
My favorite platform is Instagram. It's Cassie M as in magic,
Silva.
I did not make that up, but that's how people seem to remember it. So I'm just going to say it.
That's so cute.
It's cheesy, but...
And what's the name of your series that just came out? Because it's really exciting.
Oh, thank you. Yes, The Wayward Guide for the Untrained Eye is out on YouTube. And we have episodes coming out every week. And then there's also a parallel podcast that is out on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And any of those links you can find on my Instagram, or you can follow Tin Can Bros, and they have all the links there.
Fantastic. We'll be looking forward to it. You're such a talented, a multi-talented individual who brings a lot of love and light no matter where she goes. And I'm honored to call you a friend and guest and friend of the podcast.
Thank you. I learn from the best and I get to run with the best. So thank you so much.
And to everyone out there, a million grilled cheese sandwiches.
Wishing you a million grilled cheese sandwiches.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.